All right. Well, good morning, everybody. Welcome to the final day of our board meeting this month. Before we start our discussions, two short announcements. First of all, the final amendments to IFRS 17 have been published this morning. Kudos to the insurance team who yet again did a tremendous job in getting this all together and resolved. In a very short time, and still they were able to do a very thorough job. Also, this is the last board meeting of Gary Kaburek and Changwu Su. Well, this is important to note, the last 2 hours at the organization, at least in this board meeting. So we expect especially brilliant contributions from them in this final meeting. We have a topic today that is very well suited for brilliant interventions, IBOR reform. Let me give the floor to Rihanna, I suppose, for some introductory comments.
Yes, thank you. And I think it's an honor that Gary and Changwu gets to end their board career on IBOR. So I think, you know, we're glad to have your votes on that. So on the IBOR Phase 2 exposure draft, the board has received 80 comment letters, and our analysis in the papers that we posted for this meeting includes all of those comment letters. And I maybe just want to highlight that we haven't received any formal comment letters from investors or analysts on this exposure draft, but we have done some outreach with individual investors and analysts, and also we've spoken to CMAC and the banking craft to get their views on the exposure draft, and their feedback is set out in Agenda Paper 14F. Now, as we've updated the board at the May meeting last month, almost all the respondents to the exposure draft agreed with the board's project, they felt that the exposure draft met the objective of providing support to preparers in applying the standards, but also still enabling users of financial statements to get or be provided with useful information about the changes coming from the reform. The respondents were also, again, highlighting the urgency of finalizing this project and making the amendments available as soon as possible. And in light of all of that, they have, urged the board to not, despite making some requests for clarifications or improvements to the proposed amendments, they don't want the amendments to be delayed in order to accommodate any of those suggestions. So despite their agreement with the proposals, there are some requests for clarifications in some areas. And we've structured the papers for this meeting so that there's a paper for each question in the exposure draft so that we could keep the discussion focused on that specific matter. So we've got a question for each, or a paper for each question, except for question 3, which we will bring back to the board in July to discuss. And the reason for that is just we want to make sure we have properly considered and responded to all the feedback we received on that question. But with that, I will hand over to Lira to start off with paper 14A.
Thank you, Rihanna. Thank you. So agenda paper 14A provides a feedback from comment letters on the first question of the exposure draft, which related to the proposed amendments to IFRS 9, IFRS 4, and IFRS 16 for modifications of financial assets and financial liabilities. As noted from the feedback summarized in section 4 of the paper, generally, respondents supported the board's proposed amendments with respect to modifications. Specifically, respondents broadly agreed with the scope, with the population of changes to which the practical expedient would apply. They also agreed with the outcome resulting from applying the practical expedient to such changes. Respondents said that the practical expedient would provide significant relief to preparers while still allowing them to continue to provide useful information to users of financial statements about the financial assets and financial liabilities, which reference benchmarks subject to interest rate benchmark reform. That said, many respondents identified some areas that may need drafting improvements and made suggestions accordingly, which we more fully describe in the paper. The details of feedback received and staff analysis are included in Section 4 of Agenda Paper 14A. On the basis of the analysis, we recommend that the board finalize, without substantial changes, the draft amendments to IFRS 9, IFRS 4, and IFRS 16 set out in the exposure draft with respect to modifications of financial assets and financial liabilities. As mentioned earlier, we will consider the drafting suggestions made by respondents when preparing the final amendments. With that, I'll direct your attention to questions for the board in page 16 of the paper. Firstly, to see whether board members have any questions on the feedback received or staff analysis, and then ask whether you agree with the staff recommendation, which is set out in paragraph 5 of the paper.
Okay.
So I'll hand over to the board.
Yeah, shall we first see who has comments or questions? Sue?
Thanks, Hans. So a couple of observations. Firstly, I should say that I agree with the staff analysis and the recommendation to basically finalise what's in the what was in the exposure draft on these topics, but just a couple of comments and suggestions maybe to think about during drafting. So firstly, the easier one. So we got a number of comments from people about whether required really meant required as in compulsory, particularly in jurisdictions where a rate might be phased out, but you're not required as such to change. I agree with your analysis there. I think the word required is quite tricky unless it's put in the right place. So from a drafting perspective, I wonder whether the word necessary is going to be easier to work with rather than placing so much reliance on the word required as such. So changes that are necessary to as a result of LIBOR reform, I think is what we mean. Sorry, I've got quite a lot of feedback. Can people mute? And then the other thing is just on this whole notion of economic equivalence. So this is the sort of core part of the proposals here. And I think I agree with what the staff are recommending here. But I've had quite a lot of questions on this, and I think the drafting is, somebody's still typing on without mute. I think the drafting is going to be a little bit tricky here. So I just want to make sure that what I'm thinking is what you're thinking. So the main question people have asked me is, we say that we had a list of examples of things that were sort of necessary as a result of reform. So for example, we say that moving from an IBOR to a new risk-free rate with a margin would be one of the things that we would contemplate as being the type of change that we were countenancing. So I'll use that as an example. And I think what people are asking is, as long as I can identify that I'm on that list, is that where my analysis can stop? And I think the short answer to that question is yes. So I'm not expecting people to prove that the fair value of the instrument before and after the changes is the same, for example, or to run extended present value type analysis. But we are expecting that they do some level of analysis, I think, and I just want to make sure that we don't end up speaking at cross purposes with our stakeholders or with one another. So we talk about qualitative assessments. But for me, that would mean, for example, that I've looked at my old IBOR and I'm looking at the new risk-free rate that I'm going to move to, and I determine that to get the economic equivalence, my base rate, if you like, will be moving from the old IBOR to the risk-free rate with plus 5 basis points. I need to do that analysis to determine what sort of in the first instance is economically equivalent. But then if you went through and looked at the changes you'd made to your instruments and basically all that you'd done was keep the credit margin the same and move from the IBOR to the risk-free rate plus 5 basis points, that would be an example of something economically equivalent where with no further analysis you could conclude that you had satisfied the test. that's what we've got in mind, right?
Yes, correct. And I think I can see how in describing this, we almost think of as a maybe a two-step. So initially, you're looking at your benchmark rate and establishing what parameters are the economically equivalent to replace the old benchmark with a new benchmark. And secondly, you would look that those parameters that you established are economically equivalent flow through to the financial to the changes you made to the financial instruments. But I would agree with you that if for this particular change, we wouldn't think that it's necessary to further assess, for example, present value analysis.
Okay. I think it would be good to confirm that, because I've had some conversations with people where they seem to think that they need to do what we just discussed, and then as an extra check, they need to then prove the fair values are the same or something like that. And I think that is more work than what I'd anticipated they'd have to do. Thank you.
Tadeu.
Thank you, Hans. Actually, two comments on modification and economically equivalent. In relation to modification, I do support a description of what constitutes a modification in the context of the reform, and I saw many respondents welcome the description, and I agree that it will reduce the risk of inconsistent when applying the amendment, the definition. In relation to the concept of economically equivalent, I acknowledge the comment on paragraph 46 in this agenda paper that we intend to keep the notion of economic equivalent to be principle-based, and I agree with that. And I also understood from paragraph 49 that the staff is suggesting doing draft improvements to better explain the concept of economic equivalence. And I welcome these draft improvements as explained in paragraph 49 of this agenda paper, bringing more clearly the need for qualitative assessment that we just commented that when determining economic equivalence. I'm just wondering, actually, I would appreciate if the staff could clarify whether these draft improvements will consider it bringing part of the explanation in BC 28 and 29 into the text of the standard as suggested in some comment letters. Thank you.
Jungwoo.
Thank you, Hans. I agree with your recommendation, Lirates. Your paper is a very excellent paper, good analysis. But just I'm wondering, you know, whether I agree with the economic equivalence condition we need, but how do you think if we just remove this economic equivalence condition and we just keep the direct consequence condition of this reform, I'm wondering whether there is a big difference among the population that our proposal modification can be applied. Lira? Well, my question is if I agree with your recommendation, but if we remove, even though we remove the second condition, economic equivalence, if we just keep that the first condition, the direct consequence condition, I guess there is no big difference between these two populations.
I can make an observation on that if it's helpful, Lira. I think actually this notion of economic equivalence is important. I think it's important that it's not overread in the way that I was sort of saying I'd heard some people thought we might mean. But I think it's helpful in terms of helping people understand what the principle is that we're asking them to apply. So the way that I think about it, if I explain it to people sort of in layman's language, is we're saying you started with a financial instrument that was IBOR plus X basis points. What we're asking you to do is to look at the financial instrument you started with, that five-year instrument with IBOR plus X basis points, and then look at the instrument that you've migrated to. And is that really basically the same instrument with the only change being to adjust the fact that you can't reference to that IBOR anymore? And is that all that you've done? And I think this notion of economic equivalence is helping set the expectation that it has to just be about moving from that old rate to the new benchmark rate. And I think economic equivalence for me is helpful in explaining we really mean there shouldn't be much more that's going on beyond that. And so I think that's why it's helpful to have, just to give a clearer principle, if you like, for people to apply.
Okay, thanks.
Yes, correct. And I think in terms of, I guess, as we understand the objective of interest rate benchmark reform, we wouldn't expect an instrument to have affected the interest rate benchmark reform to be required to do other changes. So I think that's why we think these two conditions are aligned with also the objective of the reform, if you like.
So do we agree that the staffs should finalize these proposals without substantial change, as asked in question two?
Mary?
Yes.
Okay, 14.
Okay. So we move to paper 14B?
Yes. So agenda paper 14B addresses the feedback we've received on question two in the exposure draft, and specifically this is about the changes to the hedging relationships that we are requiring entities to make as a result of the modifications they've made to the hedged items and the hedging instruments. In the exposure draft, we've proposed that entities would make these changes to the hedged risk, the hedged item, and the hedging instrument. So in other words, changing the description and the designation of these hedging relationships so that they no longer refer to the IBOR rate, but that they refer to the alternative benchmark rate. Most respondents, as I've said in the beginning, agreed with these proposals, and they said that it would enable entities that have modified their financial instruments to continue applying hedge accounting because there's not much change in the underlying instruments, and therefore it wouldn't have a big change or difference in the hedging relationship. However, they have required some clarifications around the scope and the timing of these required changes that needs to be made. We've set out our staff analysis on these issues in paragraph 18 to 35 of the paper. And based on our analysis, we are recommending that the proposed amendments, it's finalized, but that we just add a reference to the examples of the modifications that are required by the reform, like we've had in paragraph 694 of the exposure draft, into the hedge accounting section so that we have consistency between those type of changes that should be made. We are also recommending that we, as part of the required changes to the hedged item, that we include reference to the fact that the designated portion of this hedge can also be amended. So if the entity had a LIBOR hedge where the fixed rate, for example, was 5%, that they can adjust that to take into account the RFR hedge and the spread between RFR and LIBOR. And lastly, we want to clarify that the intention with using the words as and when these changes happen in the exposure draft was really meant to say, you know, when these changes occur, an entity should make changes to the hedging relationships, but we didn't mean they had to do it at the date that, you know, uncertainty ended. So we don't want them to have that burden of determining what the exact date is, but we think it is important that there is a clear date by when it should happen. And because these changes would affect measurement in the financial statements of the hedged item and the hedging instrument, we think it's important then to clarify that those changes at least should be made by the next reporting date, so the reporting date after uncertainty has ended. And so with that, I'll see if anybody has any questions or comments on the feedback and the staff analysis before we go to the question.
I should give the floor to Sue.
Rhianna, I agree with the staff analysis and your suggestions, but just one confirmation. So I think that people probably tripped up on the words that we had in paragraph 6.9.7, which focused a lot on the fact that the hedge would be adjusted only for the change in the alternative benchmark rate, which I think is why they've reacted the way that they have. So, and I agree with where you're heading. I just wonder whether it would be helpful in terms of capturing, I think, what we mean, to sort of reinforce the idea that, given that we're going to have to soften the words slightly, but we don't want them to sort of be misread, that we, I think, anticipate there would be, you're only going to make changes to the hedge that you need to make as a result of the change in benchmark reform as well. So, for example, that...
Can I ask everybody to be on mute when you don't speak?
I think it's Mary. I think that the intention would be that there'd be consistency between how you designated the old hedge and how you would designate the new hedge as a general principle. Is that right? So if you're designating the hedge before to with reference to IBOR flat, then basically you'd just be designating now to capture the risk-free rate plus the margin that gets you to the equivalent of IBOR flat, and not suddenly changing to include the full credit spread, as an example. Is that fair?
Yes, I think that's exactly right, and that's why we were trying to be a bit strict about the changes. Yes, we don't want the relationships to be completely changed from what they were before. We only want the changes that are directly necessary because of the reform.
Good. I agree with that. Thanks.
Tadeo?
Thank you, Hans. Actually, it's just, again, just asking for a clarification. When we have a hedging documentation, and I, from the moment that we have any change, we have to update the documentation. But I understood, and I think before I say that, I believe it's welcome. But just to clarify that if I have any change in relation to this specific situation of the reform, we have to make the adjustment to the documentation by the end of the reporting period, during which the uncertainty in respect to the elements of the range relationship have been resolved. Just to clarify that, because usually today, what we have to adjust the documentation as we have any change or at the beginning of the hedge. In this case, because of the reform, what we are providing to preparers is more time to have this documentation ready. Is it correct?
In a way, it might be, but I don't think it's necessarily, because even in practice today, there are situations where the hedge designation is changed, but, you know, it takes a couple of days or a week or so to get to the documentation itself. And in the context of IBOR, where there's going to be a lot of changes made at the same time, I can fully understand that entities say it's difficult to update the documentation of all of these hedges at one, you know, at a specific point in time. But I think our focus is more on the designation of the hedge. So in other words, what are you measuring and what are you hedging against? And at least making those changes to your designation by the end of the reporting period so that you capture the right changes in fair values and cash flows when you make your ineffectiveness assessment. So it is giving a little bit, maybe extra, but not significantly different from what we have even today.
Okay, it's just because that I might have situation that may end up occurring in the very end of the reporting period, and then I would have a bit more time to deal with that. That's my question. Thank you very much, Rhianna.
Okay.
Martin?
Yeah, thanks, Hansman. I agree with the staff recommendation on this issue. Mine also, 3 points. It is clearly a clarification, and I, from my understanding, it was what we had in mind. So I'm totally in line with what staff is recommending. So I'm happy with that.
Thank you.
Jin Chao.
Thank you, Hans. I also agree with staff's recommendation. I think those clarification is necessary and very important. I just want to confirm one thing and one clarification about other changes to the hedging relationship, particularly with regard to the basis swaps. First, I understand we needed to draw a line to limit the types of changes that are made to hedging relationship, which at the entity do not need to, you know, have to discontinue applying hedging accounting. And suppose, and I also agree, if those swap, those basis swap are optional, that means there are options for the entity, and even they are economic, they meet the economic, you know, equivalence criteria, I think they should not be regarded as meet the those type required changes to hedging relationship. The question I have is that if those basis swap are not optional, that is required by, you know, central clearing, you know, entity, something like that, and they are also done on individual basis rather than aggregated basis, and they also meet the condition of economic equivalence, whether they can, you know, fit in this criteria as one type of changes that are made to hedging relationship, and the entity do not necessary to discontinue hedging accounting.
So this last scenario that you described on the basis swaps, we cover in agenda paper 14G. That's, we talk about it then. So maybe we can come back to your question when we talk about that paper. In this paper, we are more talking about the basis swaps that entities may now want to include, because there's a, you know, the computation of the different benchmark rates between the derivatives and the loans are different. The loans want a forward-looking rate so that customers knows what they pay. The derivatives are more based on the compounding, the daily compounding of the overnight rate. And so there might be a basis difference between those rates, but it's not really a basis difference between two different rates that we talk about in the other paper. So in this case, we felt it is necessary to maintain the boundaries around what is necessary to, you know, what are the necessary changes we need to make as a result of the reform. And that's why in this paper for these kinds of basis swaps, we're saying we don't think they are necessary as a result of the reform. And therefore, we don't want to start allowing all these optional changes an entity wants to make, which I think goes back to some of what Sue's point was around other changes as well. But we'll come back to your other question when we get to agenda paper 14G.
Okay, Rika? Rika, I think you're on mute. Yeah, okay, yeah.
Am I okay? Yes. Yeah. I agree with the recommendations, but it's just a clarification about the paragraph 22 of this paper. And I understand from the perspective of the exposure draft of the paragraph 6.9.7 and IS-39's paragraph 1020, aligning the example with paragraph 6.9.4 included seems very, I mean, targeted and reasonable amendment to make as staff proposed. But on the other hand, I want to make sure that the original paragraph 6.9.4 it's limiting the example as included there. So there is a kind of the intention of that paragraph exists. So will it be included in the future drafting of the modifying paragraph 6.9.7?
I think to an extent we'll have to see how it comes out in drafting and what's the best way to draft it. I don't think the intention is to include the whole of that paragraph in the hedge accounting section, but maybe just the reference that if you've changed the underlying loan, for example, mm-hmm. the reset dates of the rate or the way that the benchmark rate is compounded and you know, so those other changes in 6.9.4, that, you know, of course those changes need to flow through to the changes you are making to your hedged item as well and the way mm-hmm. you describe the hedged item. So it's more a consistency point, I think, than really changing what yeah. we have in 6.9.7 in the ED. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Yes.
Okay. So I think
all your inclusion will be relevant.
Yeah.
Thank you.
I think we are ready to vote. Can I see who agrees with the questions? Question one. Okay, Rihanna.
Okay. So then we move on to agenda paper 14D, which is dealing with the feedback we've received on question 4 in the exposure draft around risk components and how to or when to assess the separately identifiable requirement. And as you may recall in the discussions we've had before the ED was exposed, we were looking at a situation where entities have to change the hedge risk and the description of the hedged item to a new rate. But because it's quite early in the transition process, some of these new rates may not necessarily meet the separately identifiable criteria at that date that it is made. And in the exposure draft, we proposed that if an entity has a reasonable expectation that this new rate will meet the separately identifiable criteria at the end of 24 months from that date, then the entity can deem that rate to be separately identifiable at the date that it designated that risk in the hedging relationship. So it wasn't giving a relief from the separately identifiable criteria, it was just giving a bit of time, you know, period of grace for these rates to develop. Now, most of the respondents agreed with our proposals because for these reasons, I said it would give them time to get their hedges changed and to make the changes to the hedged item and the hedge risk while these rates are still developing without resulting in the hedges being discontinued. However, some respondents did raise some questions around how this 24-month period should be applied and really when it should start and when it should end. And a lot of these respondents were concerned about the fact that the 24-month period may start to apply to different entities at different times, but it also applies to individual hedging instruments in which the same rate has been designated as the hedge risk. And so the situation could arise where one hedging relationship, you know, sort of fails the assessment, the entity says it no longer has an expectation that it would meet the requirements at the end of the 24-month period, but for other hedging relationships in that rate, there's still time left. And so it just feels like if it fails for one hedging relationship, it would fail for all hedging relationships in which that rate has been designated. So we have set out our staff analysis in paragraphs 18 to 30. And based on our analysis, we are recommending finalizing the proposals in the exposure draft, subject to clarifying that the 24-month period should apply to a specific rate. So if I've got, let's say, an RFR rate that I've designated, the 24-month period will start when on the date that I first designated this rate, and then the 24-month period would apply, it would run for that. So any subsequent hedges, I still need to assess whether it's separately identifiable, but the period over which my reasonable expectations should be formed would then be slightly shorter because it's after the beginning of the 24 months. So And you know, I just want to be super clear that we are not saying entities should only assess the separate cloud identifiable criteria for the first edge and then don't have to do it again for any subsequent edges within that period. Every edge should still be assessed. It's just the period is slightly shorter. So I'm happy to take any questions or, you know, hear your thoughts on this clarification before we go to the question.
Sue?
Thanks. So I should start by saying I don't have a strong view in either direction on this one, because it's, you know, we acknowledged ourselves that 24 months was just relatively arbitrary, but designed to be helpful. I guess, and I think I find it difficult to get too excited about comparability when I'm talking about hedge accounting, given hedge accounting is optional anyway to start with, but if people have raised that, then they've raised it. I guess I'm just wanted to check with you one thing. So I thought that what we'd proposed was a hedge by hedge 24-month test. And so that gives, I think, a bit more relief than what we're proposing here now, because if you designate something in a few years' time, in theory, the 24 months starts to tick from that period in time, whereas now you've got a sort of finite 24 months to work with. So are people really that concerned about sort of operationality and comparability that they want less relief, I guess, is my question. I mean, if we think people are really asking for that, then so be it. That's my first thing. But in terms, and then just one observation, I guess that if we're going to change it this way, so that it means that basically your 24 months start ticking for a rate by rate, if you like, for an entity, I think it makes it particularly important to be clear when the clock starts to tick. And where I think this matters is for situations peeking forward to transition, where we reinstate old hedges, because I think you could argue that the reinstatement starts, you know, was an old hedge, so you go back to the date of the reinstatement or from the date you apply the new requirements. I think we should just be specific which applies if we're talking about reinstated hedges, and personally I'd be happy for the clock to start ticking from the date of initial application of the requirements. But I guess just your thoughts on whether they really meant they want less relief.
I guess that's a difficult question to answer. I think from a staff perspective, we are also not, I don't think we necessarily feel too strongly about whether we keep what was in the exposure draft and let every hedge have a different starting and ending date and, you know, just let it go through. But in a way, I can also see that there is, you know, good reasons to have it applied to a rate, because that means there is a sort of like a natural end date at which you could apply this relief, because, you know, and especially for new hedges, it could happen that, you know, a number of years after now, an entity could still say, well, it's because of the relief or it's because of the reform that I'm designating this new rate and it doesn't meet the requirements, so I get to apply the 24 months. So it gives a natural end date, I think, to the relief, and it makes it clear that this relief really is temporary in the way that we've intended it in the exposure draft. So it's purely from that perspective, I think, that we've made the recommendation we have made in the paper.
Okay. Tadeo?
Thank you, Hans. Rianne, it's just a clarification whether in this 24 month period, whether there will be some disclosure requirements until we get the confirmation, what is expected.
No, we don't have any disclosure requirements around this at the moment.
But are we planning to add that, or?
We are not making any recommendations around this, because not specifically this, but it might be covered by the whole, the overall disclosure, which deals with the progress the entity has made and how it's made the transition to the new rates. But there's nothing specific on this.
Okay, thank you.
Martin?
Yeah, thanks, Hansman. I'm also not so sure if you should make that change, because my understanding was also that clock is ticking from each hedge. which are doing that, and respondents now say they are concerned for, I understand the situation where for the same kind of rates and maybe the relief is hatching for one or not for the others, and if you come to the conclusion it is not separately identifiable, then maybe you end one hatch and the others not. But my question is, when this relief it is not mandatory, I think you don't have to. And if you conclude, because my understanding is the relief is you still have an expectation. And if you don't have an expectation that it is separately identifiable, you can also close the other hedge. If you conclude, okay, for the first one, you come to the conclusion that it's not. Or is that a wrong assumption from my side? And, but if not, I would say we stay with the old one, because mine is concerns that people have. I don't know if they are really so valid.
Okay. Rian, do you want to get in? No? Rika?
I saw to Gary.
Go ahead, Rika. Yeah. I'll follow you.
Yeah, okay. So, ladies first, Rika.
Okay. Thank you very much, Gary. I think I agree with Sue and Martin. It's really important when the clock starts ticking. So I want to make sure with the staff about the fact we consider that is the basis of our proposal. And so paragraph 21 and of this paper, it's mentioned that an entity could delay the designation of late that doesn't meet the requirement. So we have a condition set for considering this timing and the period of 24 months based on that. So I just wondering, there is any case that will not controllable for entity, and the entity have to designate the late without their intention. Is that any case that can be happened? Do you have any thought or?
I'm not sure if there's really any cases where entities could be forced to do anything for hedge accounting purposes, because it is based on risk management and it's based on, you know, what it is they want to manage from a risk perspective. So I don't think a regulator could force an entity to make changes to hedging relationships. It could maybe force it to make the changes to the underlying instruments, which could have knock-on consequences on the hedging relationships. But I think our intention, or what we meant in that paragraph, was just to say it's entities are not, because there's no requirement, yes, the derivatives might move this year at some point, but that doesn't mean the hedging hedged items need to move. That's up to the entity as when they do those negotiations, when they change the contracts. And similar to the hedging relationships, the entity decides when to do that. So that's why we don't think we need to have a longer period than 24 months, because an entity really controls when that 24-month period starts by making the changes. And so if the rates are not ready yet, they don't have to make the change yet.
Okay. Thank you, Rihanna.
Okay. Can I see? I think there are no further questions.
No, I want to.
Thank you, Gary.
Oh, Gary. Yeah.
Jeez, my last meeting and just.
Yeah, sorry about that.
Just a few comments, and first, I support the staff's recommendation, and I'm one of those people who thought a lot about the 24 months, and going back a few months ago, actually wondering should it be more open-ended, not even necessarily defined, you know, 36 months, but I just thought it should have been open-ended, but I did change my thoughts on that. I think because it is a transitional relief, I do think it has to be, have a back-end date in 24 months. I think we just be clear, it's just judgmental, but it feels like it's long enough in there. So I support 24 months. I support having an end date on all these things. And I think to somebody's comment, I think it was Sue's, about is anyone asking for less relief? And at least my experience, preparers never ask for less relief. They're less concerned about the theoretical purity of all these things. It's just, it does it work for me or not? So I can't imagine preparers looking for less relief. I think, to me, I think the key thing in here, and I was confused until we had a meeting the other day on it, is what does 24 months mean? It means it actually runs over several years, you know, depending on when your environment that you're operating in starts to go into the reform and so on. So I think WIS need to be very clear in whether it's the basis or educational materials. 24 months actually could last several years, depending on when an environment starts the process. I think over time, and I'm talking really more for commercial industrial companies, they're in a different spot than financial institutions, whereas financial institutions are trying to manage interest rate risks as part of their business on both sides of the balance sheet and so on, whereas commercial industrial companies, it's a simpler interest rate risk you're trying to manage. You're trying to manage your interest expense, period, not to manage a net interest income or something. So I instinctively think it'll be easier for them to do in it. And also, I think we should point out that the significance of the relief, once it starts, will wind down over time. You know, as instruments mature, do you go into the new whatever your new reference rate is. So it'll be most important the day one, the 24-month period starts, but it will wind down. I don't know how quickly, but it does get progressively less important. So for that, I think 24 months should do the job and support the staff recommendation.
Okay. Are we ready to vote? I think we are. Can I please see support for the staff's recommendation?
Twelve.
Okay, then I think we go to Liz Figge.
Sure, good morning. So turning to agenda paper 14E, that discusses the proposals related to effective date and transition. For efficiency, I plan to tee up both topics at the same time before opening the floor for comments or questions. With respect to the effective date, the ED proposed that entities would be required to apply the amendments for annual periods beginning from the application for 2021 with earlier application permitted. Almost all respondents that commented on this topic agreed with the proposal, and we recommend that the board finalize it. With respect to transition, the ED proposed that entities would apply the amendments retrospectively in accordance with ISA. As a result, entities would be required to reinstate a discontinued hedging relationship if and only if the entity had discontinued that relationship solely because of changes required by interest rate benchmark reform. Almost all respondents that commented on transition generally agreed with and indeed welcomed these proposals. However, as described in paragraphs 9 to 12 of the paper, some respondents asked the board to reconsider a particular aspect of the proposal that would require entities to reinstate some discontinued relationships. And they provided suggestions on how the board might be able to change the proposal to address the concerns that they raised. We agree with these respondents that entities shouldn't be required to reinstate a discontinued hedging relationship if, for example, the hedging instrument or the hedged item has been subsequently designated into a new hedging relationship or no longer exists at the date of initial application of the amendments. Therefore, we recommend that the board finalize the transition requirements proposed subject to the change set out in paragraph 3 of the paper. So specifically, an entity would reinstate a discontinued hedging relationship if and only if the entity discontinued that relationship solely due to changes required by interest rate benchmark reform, and at the date of initial application of the amendments, the discontinued hedging relationship still meets the risk management objective on the basis of which it qualified for hedge accounting and continues to meet all other qualifying criteria after taking into account these amendments. So I'll stop there and see if there's any questions or comments before we move to the questions?
Anne.
Thanks, Hans. Thanks, Lizzie. Thanks, Liz. I thought the paper addressed the feedback well. I thought that the paper set out what the problem was as the respondents saw it. I thought in relation to 3A, your coverage of IS8 as covering the impractical when it is impractical, I thought that made sense. And then the addition, the new material in paragraph B, I did think that addressed the specific things that people had brought up about what might be happening to the hedges, that they're no longer available, or they've been moved into trading, or those sort of things. So without having to individually address scenarios, I think what you've put there covers those types of examples and potentially other ones that may exist. So I was happy with the change. So I support the staff recommendation on this one. Thank you.
Thanks. I also agree with the staff recommendation. This, again, I think was intended to be helpful rather than harmful. So I think it's good to address these concerns. I like the way you propose doing it. In particular, I like the fact that we're building on the concept that we already have with the words in IFRS 9 about the sort of the strategy or whatever the word is that we've used. Just to confirm, though, given the vote on the last paper, does the staff agree and does the board then agree that it would be helpful to be explicit that if you've got a situation where you have a reinstatement of a hedge and there's a question about the separability, that we would be happy for the 24 months to start from the date of initial application, just to be explicit and clear on that point?
From my perspective, I definitely agree that that suggestion makes sense. So I think we can put that into the transition requirements in a very straightforward manner.
With this slight amendment, can I see whether the board members support the staff's recommendation?
Mary?
Yes.
14.
Okay. Are we going back to Lira?
Yes, thank you. So agenda paper 14F provides feedback analysis for question 6 in the exposure draft, which related to the proposed amendments to IFRS 7 for additional disclosures related to interest rate benchmark reform. The feedback received on the disclosure proposals comprises feedback from both comment letters, as summarized in paragraph 12 to 21 of the paper, and the additional outreach that Rihanna mentioned with users of financial statements, summarized in paragraphs 8 to 11 of the paper. Almost all respondents that commented on disclosure proposals, including here the feedback from users of financial statements, they supported the disclosure objectives proposed in paragraph 24I of the exposure draft. These respondents also broadly agreed with the disclosure requirements proposed in paragraph 24J of the exposure draft. However, many respondents made some suggestions, and in particular, the following two suggestions. Firstly, that the board permit entities to select the basis for providing the quantitative information required by the proposed disclosure in paragraph 24JB. And the second suggestion was that the board reconsider the proposed disclosure in paragraph 24JC of the exposure draft on the basis that the resulting information from this proposal may not always provide useful information to users of financial statements. So on the basis of our analysis set out in paragraphs 22 to 34 of the paper, which also takes into account the feedback received from users, the staff recommend that the board finalize the proposed disclosures in paragraph 24i to 24g with the following two changes. The first change would be to amend paragraph 24jb to permit that an entity choose the representative basis for disclosing the quantitative information, and that basis would be explained in the financial statements. Examples of possible basis for providing this quantitative information are described in paragraph 29 of the paper. The second change would be to delete the proposed disclosure in paragraph 24JC of the exposure draft. With that, I would like to open the floor for any questions on the feedback or staff analysis, and then secondly, ask the question whether you agree with the recommendation.
Jin Chao.
Thank you, Han. Just one comment about the quantitative disclosure, because we changed it previously, specifically mentioned that it should be carrying amount of those items, but now we are going to more broadly sense quantitative information. And the examples given in paragraph 29 is very useful, but I'm wondering how we'll address those examples in the basic conclusion or in the standard itself. Secondly, whether there is any hierarchy of those examples. You know, first, those entities need to go to look at the carry amount of those items. If it's costly, then go to the next one. Then finally, depends on the amount internally reported or managed, internally reported. So I wonder whether there are any criteria, particularly for the third one, if the entity just go to the third one, depends on the internal reporting information. And I wonder whether there are any criteria in which situation those entities needed to go to the third one. And in which situation, if they need to go to the first one, if those carrying amounts are available to the users as well, to the user as well. So I just wondering, it's just a free choice, or whether there are some certain criteria for entity to choose what kind of quantitative information they need to provide to the users.
Okay, so I think. Firstly, if I can just start with what helped us when we were contemplating about this change is that the objective of this disclosure was to provide information that would allow users to understand the magnitude of financial assets and financial liabilities that still reference a rate that will that is subject to the reform. And so in understanding feedback from comment letters that said to meet that objective, we might not be able to provide carrying amount without undue cost or effort, but we could provide in a basis that's, for example, consistent to what we provide to key management personnel, and then. When we were talking to users, I think the point that they brought was important in the sense that even applying the proposal in the exposure draft, so if entities would provide the carrying amount of financial assets and financial liabilities, that information, because it's a subset, that would still not be able to reconcile back to the financial statement line items. So in a sense, as long as the information provided clearly gives the sense of the magnitude of what is left to move to the alternative benchmark rate, we thought that could still be aligned with the objective that this disclosure is designed to achieve. So I think to your example, obviously we would expect that for entities that have available the carrying amounts, and that's consistent to how they are looking at the progress milestones, then that would be disclosed. But I don't think we were contemplating at this stage to have a sort of a hierarchy. I think we were more thinking that the entity would be able to select the most representative basis and explain that.
Sue?
Thanks. I was going to comment on this same point, this proposal to change from being so prescriptive about the basis on which this analysis would be provided. So I agree with what the staff propose in terms of not needing to be so prescriptive about the basis on which this information is provided. But I think it's going to be really important that we are clear in establishing what the sort of objective of this disclosure is. And for me, I think we're trying to perhaps do two things. One is to so we'd want people to provide this in a way that enables users of financial statements to get an understanding of how much work is still left to do. And I think it would be useful to emphasise, I think, that that is interesting in the context of the total population that the entity has. So some sort of, you'd want an explanation that enables you to have some idea of whether a billion is half of the balance sheet or 1% of the balance sheet. If we're talking particularly notional amounts where it might be very hard to understand how that relates to carrying amounts. So we're probably interested in that relativity relative to the size of the entity and its total financial instruments. And I think the other thing, just thinking about it in the last day or so, that we might want to think about emphasising somehow is, If somebody said to me, I've still got $1 billion worth of derivatives that I need to restructure, that might sound like, you know, a horrendous amount of work to do, unless you then said, and by the way, I've already modified $100 billion in the last 6 months. So I think something that gives you an idea of how much progress has been made relative to my total population I've got to deal with, and maybe something that gives you an idea of, you know, how much work is that. So these relativities, I think, matter as much as the basis on which the number is calculated and provided. And somehow I think bringing that concept of relativity through as part of this notion of, I want the information that enables me to sort of assess how much progress have you made and how much is still left to do, which I think has naturally got a relativity aspect to it.
Okay. Nick, and then Gary.
Thank you, Hans. So just on the two suggestions proposed in this paper by staff. So first of all, on 24JC, which is around understanding how the entity is affecting the reform, I agree with deleting that requirement and the concerns that that will just provide boilerplate information. On 24JB, I agree, I think, really with what Sue said. This is about the sense of progress. How far have I got through this program? How much more have I got to do? And so I am entirely open to using alternative quantitative measures, but we do need this relative. You know, if you give me X, I want to know that's X of what's Y as well. Either what the total is, without just giving me X in isolation, really, potentially given that we've opened this up to alternative measures, doesn't necessarily help me at all. So it needs to have that benchmark, that relative benchmark, to give that sense of progression. Thank you.
Gary, and then Martin.
Yeah. Thank you. Just a question for the staff then. But before I ask, let me second some of the recent discussion about the need for measures of progress in it. To my way of thinking, the date your company or your environment or in your interest rate environment, you transition to it. That's the date of the most exposure. Because this has got to be a declining curve as new business transitions to the new reference rate. Well, the old business is finite and it slowly declines. But I think a measure of progress in any reasonable way absolutely makes a lot of sense. Secondly, to a question to the staff, and this is just to refresh my memory. The disclosures we're talking about here, they apply to all instruments or only those that are in hedging relationships? And is the intention is the disclosures, if it's intended to apply to all, that we're going to require you to talk about those in hedging relationships separate from those that are not? This is just a clarifying question. I don't have an issue with what we proposed. I just don't remember what it was.
Correct. So I think for this particular disclosure proposals, if we're talking about the scope, I think we were thinking in to be aligned with the phase two amendments in general, which extend beyond financial instruments that are designated to hedging relationships. So in other words, these instruments would be disclosed even if they are not designated in a hedging relationship. We have a particular, so that's paragraph 24JD, which is more specific to hedging. And then we mentioned in the exposure draft as well that to the extent that the phase one disclosures would apply, those are specific to hedge accounting and they would still be available.
Martin?
Yeah, thanks, Hansman. I also agree with the staff recommendation not to stick to this carrying amounts. And but as in other projects, we going more and more to disclosure objectives and say, okay, what we want to have is kind of the progress of how companies' entities are in line with this reform and how they have managed to then transition their products to that. And therefore, I think it should be the disclosure objective is a kind of measure of progress in this kind of journey. And then we give some examples, if you have in your paper, say, what quantitative measures could it be? And therefore, I'm happy with this staff recommendation.
Mary?
Just building on what Gary and Martin were saying, I think this is building on their comments. I think the Gary's point about it's likely to be at its maximum on day one and then declining, it sounds like we need to get across that you need some quantum on day one. And then as Martin said, I think the key word for me as I look back on the disclosures that we have is proportion. We are trying, you know, and as Martin was saying, I think we should be focusing on the disclosure objective. So I support the staff recommendation in terms of both the deletion and the flex that they're proposing. But I think what we need to communicate most importantly, and this is Sue's point about a billion sounds big until you understand it in context, is we're trying to get people to disclose the proportion. So, you know, I say to the staff, do you think that that's a word or a concept that you can try and emphasize in the modifications here? Sorry, modifications to the drafting.
Yes. Thanks, Mary. I think these are all useful comments, and I think my initial reaction would be that it wouldn't, it's consistent with our thinking. For example, I've been thinking that this disclosure in 24JB is a good supplement, and I think some respondents also said it, that it's a good supplement to what we have in 24JA, which is explaining the progress at the reporting date. And so to me, the proportion feels like it fits with what we currently have, but potentially a better articulation. So we'll think about that.
Okay, I think we're ready to vote. Can I see who supports the staff recommendation?
Mary?
Yes.
14.
Okay, then we go back to Rihanna.
Yes. So agenda paper 14G deals with some feedback that we've received in the exposure draft that wasn't linked to a specific question that we've asked. But what respondents raised and some of the comments said was that derivative contracts may not necessarily be modified, especially those that are cleared through central clearinghouses. They might prefer to rather replace the derivatives with an alternative benchmark rate derivative or achieve the same outcome as modifying the original contract, for example, by designating or issuing a basis swap that would swap IBOR for the RFR rate. So we have looked at our staff analysis, includes an analysis of the four most likely examples that we have found in the comment letters, but also that we discovered through discussions with some of the industry groups, just to better understand these examples. And the four examples we set out in the paper, the first one is where the original derivative is maintained, but there's an offsetting derivative issued to that, and then an RFR derivative that is off market. So in other words, it's got the same terms as the original IBOR derivative, it's just based on RFR. The second example is similar, but the original derivative is settled, closed out. So there's a cash payment to close it out, and it's replaced with a new derivative that is on market at the date that it's issued. So it doesn't have the same terms as that the as what the IBOR derivative had. The third example is the example that Jin Zhao mentioned earlier around issuing a basis swap. So if you add the basis swap and the original derivative together, you achieve the same outcome as a modification. And the third example was novating the original derivative to a different counterpart who then modifies the derivative in one of these ways to be an RFR derivative. Now, when we looked at these examples, we considered the requirements that was in paragraph 6.9.3 of the exposure draft around modifications that are required by the reform, and those two criteria of being economically equivalent and as a direct consequence of the reform. We thought that was quite useful to assess whether these changes in the derivatives could be seen in the same light as a modification or achieves the same outcome as modifying the original contract would. So in our staff recommendation, well, first of all, in our staff analysis, I should say this, we've looked at each of these and we've used these guidelines to measure them against. And there are some of those examples which we don't think meets the requirements to be seen as, you know, achieving the same outcome as modifying the contract, because either the original contract is derecognized and replaced with another contract, or the replacement derivative is not on the same terms. So it's got substantially different terms than the original derivative had. So our staff recommendation on this matter is that we clarify that for the purpose of the changes to the hedging instruments that are being made in the hedging relationships, that the modifications required by the reform could be made in ways other than modifying the control terms of the hedging instrument, as long as that outcome is economically equivalent to modifying the original contract. So it's only those examples where it really achieves the same objective as modifying the contract that we think should be allowed as, you know, changes to the hedging instruments other than changing the contractual terms. And I think with that, I'll hand over to you.
Okay, Sue.
Thanks, Rihanna, and thanks for the analysis. I agree with the analysis that you have in the paper and the conclusions that you reach for the reasons that you've outlined. I also agree with the staff recommendation. However, I've got one suggestion for a tweak in wording, which I think is completely consistent with your analysis and I think might be a perhaps clearer articulation of what we mean, just sort of in terms of belt and braces. I think it's implicit in what the recommendation is that we want economic equivalence, but also that there wouldn't be derecognition of the hedging instrument. And I think it would be good to be clear on those two points, which I then think means that we would definitely get to the same outcomes as the staff analysis. And also it prevents an sort of tension with what we've got in the current wordings on novation in IFRS 9 and in 39. So I agree, but I would prefer it with that explicit addition.
And I actually think that addition, you know, is the right thing to do, because if we look at the modifications, the underlying assumption for the modification changes is that the original contract is not derecognized. It's still there, and that those negotiations or the changes are being agreed to between the same counterparties because the contract is not derecognized. And so I think if we add that derecognition bit to our staff recommendation, it makes it just clearer what we mean. So I agree with that.
Jen Chow.
Thank you, Hans. Just one clarification, which related to previous question I asked. So in my understanding, the proposed amendment clarification building on the notion of economic equivalence only for the purpose of changes required for hedging instrument. And building on that, so it means that this clarification will not apply for those required changes to hedging relationship previously we discussed. So only limited to the hedging instrument, changing to hedging instrument. Is it correct?
Well, I think, well, if you refer to your previous example of the where you mentioned the basis swap, so instead of the clearing houses cancelling the original derivative or issuing a replacement RFR derivative, they issue a basis swap to swap LIBOR for RFR. And as we set out in the paper, I think there are situations where this could achieve the same outcome, but that would mean that that basis swap needs to be individual to every hedging instrument. Because we are looking at our financial instruments, the unit of account is the individual contract. And so if we want to get the same outcome as modifying that individual contract, then there needs to be a basis swap stapled, if you want, to the original derivative. It cannot be a basis swap that is done on an aggregated basis, which is, you know, sometimes the difficulty with basis swaps is that they tend to be done on an aggregated basis and not individually. But if it is individual, then I think our recommendation, even as clarified by Sue's suggestion, would still apply in that case.
Mary?
I support the staff recommendation. I just wanted to make a request that we add in a few, not a lot, of specific examples. I know when going through this paper, I found the examples of the kind of four different categories. Is it four? You know, the close and replace, terminate and replace, et cetera. Very helpful for particularly about the comments about on and off market replacements. I'm suggesting the examples less to try and illustrate every possible fact pattern, which is why I say only a few. But I think the logic, the analysis that's provided with the examples is very helpful in terms of understanding how the fundamental disciplines of required buyer necessary because of the reform in economic equivalence come into play in these assessments, especially if we're moving it, you know, into the land of a lot of possible permutations. So my comment is a plea for a few judicious examples.
Okay. Rika?
Thank you, Hans. Just a clarification question about the close out and replace example. I think I agree with the staff analysis, and if we put any exception about this type of the thing, that we will go beyond the assessment of economic equivalent, what we propose here. So that's my understanding. But still, I also think if we were to provide any relief for this case of close out and replace, that means maybe we also need to touch other part of the IFRS 9 and IS 39 to address the issue, like the recognition requirement or other. Is my understanding correct?
Yes, I think that's fair. Because there are specific requirements in both IFRS 9 and IS 39 that if the hedging instrument, for example, is expired or it is, you know, closed out, that results in the direct or the discontinuation of the hedging relationship. You can no longer meet the qualifying criteria. And so if we were to give any exception or relief in this case, it would mean we would have to make other changes to IFRS 9 as well, which I think could have quite significant knock-on consequences in other situations and you know, not just catering for the specific one. So I think it would be quite difficult actually to frame and to scope those kind of changes.
Thank you, Leanne.
Tom?
Yeah, I think along similar lines to Mary, I found the approaches described in paragraph 5 to be really useful. And I think some of that content should be in the ultimate document. I'm not sure whether it's in the basis or via examples or wherever. I'll let staff decide, but I think that was really helpful.
Thank you.
Okay. I think we are ready to vote. Can I see who supports the staff's recommendation? Mary?
Yes.
14.
Then I believe we're going to the final paper, which will be introduced by Christos.
Yes, so agenda paper 14H summarizes the comments on areas that were not directly addressed by the exposure draft. More specifically, this paper discusses comments expressed by a few respondents in relation to the following two issues. The first one is related to the practical challenges encountered when doing the assessment of solely payments of principal and interest, SPPI, required in IFRS 9 in circumstances when no forward-looking term rates will be officially provided, and consequently, the alternative benchmark rate may have an imperfect time value of money element. These respondents asked the board to consider providing an exemption from the SPPI requirements in these circumstances. And the second issue is related to potential unintended separation of embedded derivatives as a result of the reform. Specifically, these respondents were concerned that the transition to the alternative benchmark rates could consequently cause unintended separation of the embedded derivatives, and they suggested the board clarify that for the modified financial instruments affected by the reform, making modifications required by the reform does not give rise to the reassessment of embedded derivatives in accordance with IFRS 9. So on the basis of our analysis for each of these issues, as set out in this paper, we recommend that the board make no substantial changes to the proposals in the exposure draft in response to these issues. And with that, I would like to direct you to your attention to question for the board in page 8 of the paper, which firstly, to see whether you have any questions on the feedback, and secondly, whether you agree with the staff recommendation to make no substantial changes.
Oh, Sue wants to comment.
Surprise, surprise. Thanks, Christos. I agree with the analysis in the paper. I just wanted to make a comment on the comments that are raised in the paper and that I've heard offline about the analysis of which rates meet the requirements for solely payments of principal and interest in IFRS 9, and sort of just to build on that a little bit. So I agree completely with what the staff have said here. And I think it's, for me, not just a question of, you know, this isn't the time for it, it's not in the scope of this project, but I don't see a need to make any changes to address this issue. And the reason why I say that is that when we wrote IFRS 9, and in particular when we did the changes to classification and measurement in the second round of that for IFRS 9, we'd already had a lot of questions coming in about, you know, which rates are okay and which rates aren't okay. And, you know, I've got a rate that's not perfect, I've got average rates, all of this, you know, is that fatal? And so IFRS 9 already includes quite a lot of guidance and principles in there to help people work out whether or not their rates are what we would consider to be interest for the purposes of IFRS 9 and therefore eligible for amortized cost accounting. And that was designed at the time to make it possible for different countries around the world to pick up this new requirement and to look at the rates they had in different jurisdictions and to decide whether or not they met the requirements. And from what I understand, people were able to do that. Essentially, what's happening here is because rates are changing, people are going to need to do that analysis again for the new rates. But I think all of the tools are there in IFRS 9 to guide that through. And IFRS 9 is very principles-based on this interest front. It's not terribly prescriptive about what is interest. It asks people to think about time value of money, and it acknowledges that you can have rates that are even quote-unquote imperfect, we actually use that word, which would be considered to be interest for the purposes of IFRS 9. So while I appreciate people will have to do some analysis to get, you know, a conclusion on whether or not these new rates do meet SPPI or not, it would only be at the time that the rates are introduced. And I think we do have the framework. We can't really start saying, you know, this rate's okay, this rate's not okay. So I think we do have what people need to work with already in the standard. So I agree with the staff on that.
Any other comments? I don't think so. So are we ready to vote? Who supports the staff's recommendation?
Mary?
Yes.
14.
We should say a big thank you to staff for getting that set of papers done so quickly on such a techie issue as well. Really very impressive, guys.
Well, I believe it brings us to the end of this month's board meeting. I don't want to close the meeting before pausing again with the farewell of Gary, and Chang Wu. We are going to do a private affair later this afternoon, so let me make just some brief comments. First of all, I'm really sorry that we have to bid farewell under these circumstances, that we are not even able to shake your hand or give you a hug, which you would normally do, and you guys certainly deserve that. You were with us for 8 years, and you've made truly a very big contribution to the ISB's work. Gary has a very keen preparer's eye, given his background as a preparer for decades, but he always kept his other eye open to investor needs, and he was never dogmatic, and he, in the cost-benefit analyses, he was always very willing to balance investor needs with preparers' costs. So that was incredibly helpful in the board meetings. Your American accent clearly reveals where you're from. At the same time, I really never saw a systematic different perspective from you than from compared to other board members from other parts of the world. And that has always, you know, fed my hope that in the long run we will get America on board with IFRS as well. I don't think there are major cultural or legal differences that are bound to keep us apart. So thank you for that, Gary. And Chang Wu, very hardworking board member. Always came to the meetings well prepared, very thoroughly prepared, showing your academic background, which often includes a tendency for thoroughness. And Chang Wu, you will always remain the first Korean board member, so you deserve your place in history. I also want to say here also to our Korean stakeholders, I am sure you will not be the last Korean board member. Getting countries on board, board of 14, while we you know, have 144 countries or so applying IFRS, it's inevitable that we will have to rotate between countries. But given the immense contribution of our Korean stakeholders, and I also think about the Korean standard setter, which you will remain engaged with, to my great pleasure, I am sure Korea will come back in the board. Okay, let me keep it short. I will talk a bit more elaborately this in our private meeting this afternoon. I will see you then at 2 o'clock, and I thank all for following this board meeting. Goodbye. Goodbye.
Thank you.
Thank you. Bye.
Thanks, everyone.
Okay, see you.